Have you ever been told to fail fast?
Probably more times than you can count, right?
Oh, absolutely. I
Right.
mean, if you spend any time architecting software, writing distributed systems, or even just sitting in on engineering planning meetings, you've definitely had this phrase drilled into your head.
Yeah, it's practically a religion in modern software engineering at this point.
It really is. The dogma is basically you hit an error, you drop what you're doing, you report the failure upward, and you immediately free up the thread.
Which sounds great in theory.
Right. But what happens when blindly following that exact golden rule ends up taking down your entire production environment?
Well, it creates one of the most brutal paradoxes in system design.
Right.
You implement a pattern specifically designed to keep your infrastructure resilient and responsive, and that very mechanism mutates into a denial of service attack against your own architecture.
And that paradox is exactly our mission for today's deep dive.
It's a good one.
It really is. We are unpacking a highly detailed presentation we get our hands on. It's titled Fail Fast, But Not Too Fast.
A great title.
Yeah, and we're looking at why aggressively failing fast during transient infrastructure state changes causes these just catastrophic cascading failures.
Right. And more importantly, we're going to look at the architectural antidote to this problem.
Exactly. The implementation of bounded retries and failure boundary models. We are going to explore how to save your distributed systems from their own self-preservation instincts.
Because the overarching theme in these materials really challenges a fundamental assumption that so many engineers hold,
Which is?
that stability in a distributed system is about eliminating failure entirely.
Right.
But the reality is, hardware degrades, network packets drop, compute nodes get preempted. True stability is not about eliminating that failure, it's about containing it.
Containing it. I like that.
Yeah, it's about drawing a rigid boundary around the instability and explicitly dictating how the system behaves inside that specific perimeter. You have to prevent the chaos from leaking upward.
Okay, so let's ground this in the reality of what actually happens during a standard infrastructure failover.
Sure.
So for everyone listening, say you were running a highly available Redis cluster, or maybe a NAS Jetstream setup, and suddenly the primary node goes down.
The tale as old as time.
Right. So the sources highlight this highly critical detection and recovery window of roughly 10 to 12 seconds.
Which is a huge deal.
Yeah, because in the context of a modern web application, 10 seconds feels like an absolute eternity. You might be tempted to just sever the connection right there and throw a 500 error.
Most people do.
But what is actually occurring under the hood during that specific window?
Well, it's a tremendous amount of coordinated, distributed consensus work.
Okay.
Let's look at a raft-based system. When a leader node suddenly vanishes, the follower nodes don't instantly know it's dead.
Right, because they aren't omniscient.
Exactly. They are relying on heartbeat mechanisms. Those are usually sent every few dozen milliseconds. So when a follower misses enough consecutive heartbeats, its election timer expires.
It realizes something is wrong.
Right. It increments its current term, it transitions to a candidate state, and it begins requesting votes from the rest of the cluster to establish a new quorum.
And while the cluster is busy playing politics and electing a new leader, the client applications are just sitting there with open TCP sockets attached to a ghost.
That is precisely the issue.
Yeah.
The old leader might be partitioned, it's unable to commit new writes because it lost quorum, but crucially, it hasn't closed its client connections yet.
So the client request just hangs.
It hangs. Eventually, you hit a TCP dial timeout, or maybe a context deadline is exceeded, and then the client has to establish a completely new connection to the newly elected leader.
Which involves a whole new set of handshakes.
Exactly. TCP handshakes, TLS negotiation, all of it. That entire chaotic symphony from missing the first heartbeat to finalizing the TLS handshake on the new primary that is your 10 to 12 second window.
Okay, so the critical takeaway for you listening to this is that this represents temporary unavailability. It is not data loss. The underlying business logic you were trying to execute is still perfectly sound. The infrastructure is simply reorganizing itself.
That's the perfect way to phrase it.
So if the infrastructure is effectively just reorganizing, why would failing fast here be such a massive problem?
Well, the sources actually highlight a quote that perfectly captures this tension.
Oh yeah, the one about operational harm.
Right. It says, failing immediately during a 3-4 second window may be technically correct, but operationally harmful.
Technically correct, but operationally harmful. break that down for us.
It's technically correct because the connection did, in fact, drop at that exact millisecond. The socket is dead.
Right.
But it is operationally harmful because if you allow that low-level socket error to propagate all the way up your stack the very moment a leader election starts, you are triggering a massive, uncontrolled overreaction across your entire architecture.
Okay, let's talk about the nightmare scenario here because I think everyone listening has either caused this or been paged for this at 2 a.m.
Oh, definitely.
What happens when those raw infrastructure semantics leak directly into the business logic layer?
It creates a catastrophic load amplification cycle.
Okay.
Think of your architecture like a busy restaurant. The front-end clients are the customers, your business layer is the wait staff, and the database is the kitchen.
I love this analogy. So a failover event is like a small grease fire breaking out on the stove.
Exactly. The kitchen staff just needs 10 seconds to throw some baking soda on it, clean up, and get back to cooking.
But instead of telling the wait staff to just hold the orders for a few seconds and absorb the delay, the kitchen yells that the restaurant is burning down.
That is exactly the dynamic. Because the system is built to fail fast, the wait staff immediately runs back to the customers, drops their plates, and says, "Your order failed."
And what does a modern client application do when it receives a failure response?
It retries.
Immediately.
Yes. The customer instantly demands to place the order again. And because there are no boundaries in the scenario, you don't just have one customer retrying.
You have tens of thousands of concurrent clients.
Right. All instantly slamming the system with identical requests.
All while the kitchen is still trying to put out the grease fire. That is the classic thundering herd problem.
And it triggers what the industry formally calls a retry storm.
A retry storm.
Yeah. When the business layer gets those raw infrastructure errors and blindly passes them to the clients retry blindly. And they almost always lack proper exponential backoff or jitter.
So they all hit at the exact same millisecond.
Right. The sheer volume of incoming requests causes severe CPU spikes, memory exhaustion, thread pool starvation across all your upstream services.
Wow.
The very fail-fast mechanism that was meant to keep your threads free and responsive ends up generating a self-inflicted denial of service attack that takes the whole system offline.
I remember troubleshooting an incident exactly like this a few years ago. We had a managed database provider do a routine zero downtime minor version upgrade.
Let me guess, it triggered a brief failover.
Exactly. A 4-second failover. Totally standard stuff.
Yeah.
But the authentication microservice caught the dropped connection, immediately failed fast, and threw a raw 500 error to the front end.
Ouch.
Yeah. And the client-side code had a retry loop without any exponential backoff.
Uh-huh.
So within seconds, the auth service was utilizing 99% of its CPU, just trying to process and reject the tsunami of retry requests.
It's terrifying how fast it happens.
It really is.
Yeah.
So if failing fast during a blip causes this massive storm, how do we prevent the business layer from making terrible decisions based on these transient errors?
Well, we have to stop treating all errors as identical.
Okay.
The deep dive sources introduce a crucial concept here, which is failure categorization. Mm-hmm. You simply cannot universally apply a fail fast strategy because not all failures are created equal.
Right.
The strategy you deploy has to be entirely dictated by the semantic type of the failure you're encountering.
So we basically need to divide failures into two distinct camps. Business level failures and infrastructure level failures. Let's skip the overly simplistic examples. For an audience that's actually out there building robust systems, What does a true business level failure look like in this context?
A business level failure is a fundamental violation of state or logic.
Like what?
Think of an idempotency key collision in a payment gateway API. Or attempting to mutate a database resource that has already transitioned into a terminal state, like trying to cancel an order that has already shipped.
Right, that makes sense.
Another really good example from the material is a JWT signature mismatch during authentication.
Because for those kinds of errors, waiting 10 seconds and trying again isn't going to magically fix the idempotency collision.
No!
Or validate a forged token.
Exactly. The payload is bad. For those semantic business level errors, the correct response is absolutely to fail fast. The system must reject the request immediately and deterministically.
Because there's zero value in tying up resources to retry a fundamentally invalid operation.
None whatsoever.
But then we look at the other camp, the infrastructure level failures.
Right. The TCP connection resets, a BGP route flapping somewhere between your availability zones, a DNS resolution timeout.
Okay, so for these, the strategy completely flips.
Entirely. You do not fail fast here. You have to hold the line and absorb the failure while the underlying network stabilizes.
The challenge, of course, is how the code actually knows the difference.
That is the hard part.
Right. Because how does a high-level HTTP handler know if it's dealing with a terminal database constraint violation or just a temporary raft election?
This is where error normalization becomes critical. The documentation emphasizes that you cannot just throw a generic exception in Java or return a raw error interface in Go and just hope the upstream caller figures it out.
Because if a developer uses a catch-all exception block, the middleware might accidentally retry a 400 bad request simply because it couldn't distinguish it from a 503 service unavailable.
Exactly. The error semantics must be explicitly normalized and aligned across all layers of the stack. You need a unified error vocabulary.
A unified vocabulary. I like that.
An internal failure must be wrapped and flagged. So if you're using gRPC, for instance, you need to map that underlying socket closure to a specific status code. Is it an invalid argument, which means fail fast?
Right.
Or is it an unavailable status, signaling a transient retryable event?
And in HTTP REST terms, are you returning a hard 400 or are you returning a 503 with a retry after header?
Exactly. If your cross-layer signaling is inconsistent, your system is going to fail fast when it shouldn't, and it's going to retry when it shouldn't.
Okay, so we have our errors classified. We know we need to absorb the transient network blips to prevent that thundering herd. But where does that absorption actually live in the code?
Good question.
Because if we just scatter try-catch retry blocks everywhere, the code base turns into an unmaintainable mess.
A total nightmare.
This brings us to the core solution presented in the materials, the failure boundary model.
The boundary model is really about architectural discipline. It dictates exactly where specific resilience behaviors belong in your stack.
Okay, break that down for us.
In this model, the business layer acts as the fail fast boundary. Its entire job is to preserve semantic integrity.
And sitting right below that is the infrastructure boundary. And this acts as the retrial boundary.
Exactly. Its sole purpose is to intercept transient instability before it ever bubbles up to the business logic.
So to do this effectively, the retry logic must conform to a strict set of rules, which the sources call the bounded retry surface.
Right. The first rule is centralization. You implement this via interceptors, middleware, or maybe a dedicated sidecar proxy like Envoy.
You do not leave it up to individual developers to write custom retry loops in their specific service handlers.
Never. That's how you get uncontrolled behavior.
The second rule is that it must be time-bounded. Now, the presentation uses a strict 15-second retry budget as an example, but I actually want to push back on this.
Okay, let's hear it.
A flat 15-second budget makes total sense for a standard synchronous CRU'd app. But what if you were building a real-time bidding platform for ad tech or a high-frequency trading system?
Right.
In those environments, your latency SLAs are often in the single milliseconds. 15 seconds is an absolute eternity. Does a strict 15-second budget hold up when you're dealing with ultra-low latency requirements?
That is a very critical edge case. In a real-time bidding scenario, a 15-second budget is functionally useless because the option will have closed long before your retry succeeds.
Exactly.
But the specific duration of the budget is relative to your system's SLA. The underlying pattern remains absolute.
Okay, so the pattern holds, just the numbers change.
Exactly. If your SLA is 50 milliseconds, your infrastructure retry boundary might have a budget of 30 milliseconds. That allows for exactly one rapid speculative retry or a quick failover to a hot standby.
And if that 30 millisecond budget exhausts,
then the boundary fails deterministically and you drop the bid. Mm-hmm. The point isn't the number 15. The point is that the retry is strictly capped by a predefined temporal limit.
That makes perfect sense. And that ties directly into the third rule. Good. It must be attempt limited. Even within your time budget, whether it's 30 milliseconds or 15 seconds, you cannot just fire a tight loop of infinite requests.
No, that just brings back the retry storm. The sources recommend a maximum of 2 to 3 attempts, and usually those are paired with exponential backoff and jitter to avoid synchronizing the load.
Okay, and the fourth and final rule of the boundary model. This is arguably the most important for system hygiene.
It really is. The entire retry process must remain completely invisible to the business logic.
Invisible.
Completely. The business layer should not know that a Redis failover just occurred. It simply asks the infrastructure layer for data.
And the infrastructure layer handles the timeouts, the backoffs, the retries.
Yes. Eventually, it either hands the data over to the business layer or it hands over a normalized deterministic failure stating that the time budget was exhausted.
Let's walk the listener through the mechanics of that budget in a standard 15-second scenario, just to make it concrete.
Sure.
You make a query. Attempt number one hits a TCP timeout because a raft leader election just started.
Yeah.
The infrastructure boundary intercepts that error. It knows it's transient, so it waits. A few seconds pass. Attempt number two fires.
And let's say it hits a TLS handshake timeout because the election is wrapping up, but the new connection isn't quite ready.
Okay, so the boundary waits again. Finally, attempt number three fires. The cluster is stable, and it retrieves the data. The business layer proceeds, completely oblivious to the fact that it was shielded from two separate network failures.
Exactly. And if that 15-second budget expires or all three attempts fail, the boundary ceases all retry activity immediately.
It just cuts it off.
Right. It throws a fatal error upward. No infinite loops, no zombie processes tying up memory. Just a clean deterministic failure.
Which really moves the conversation away from just installing some popular resilience library. It introduces a much deeper philosophy. Resilience isn't a package you import. It's a cross-layer contract.
The contract model is the ultimate takeaway here. In a mature distributed system, every layer agrees to a set of operational rules. The infrastructure layer agrees to absorb transient instability. The business layer agrees to rigorously enforce semantic state and fail fast for violations.
And the client layer, the front end or the calling service, agrees to back off and retry only when it receives an explicitly normalized error code signaling that a retry is actually safe. And standardizing this contract across a large engineering organization is incredibly difficult.
Oh, it's a massive cultural shift.
But it's necessary because this pattern isn't just a quirky workaround for a specific database. The sources are really emphatic about this.
Yeah, they are.
This applies to NAS Jetstream. It applies to Kafka leader elections. It applies to distributed SQL databases like CockroachDB or Spanner. Any stateful dependency that relies on distributed consensus and leader election is going to exhibit these transient unavailability windows.
It is a universal truth for managing stateful applications at scale. As the presentation explicitly notes, this is not a Redis pattern. This is a distributed systems pattern.
So if we look at the journey we have taken today for this deep dive, we've moved from the panic of a 2 a.m. retry storm to this really elegant idea of a cross-layer contract.
It's a powerful shift.
We know that failing fast is vital for business logic, but it's basically suicidal during transient infrastructure events like leader elections.
Yeah.
We know that when we do absorb those infrastructure failures, we have to enforce strict centralized boundaries based on time budgets and attempt limits.
Right.
And we know that none of this works unless we normalize our error semantics across the entire stack.
It represents a fundamental paradigm shift for many engineers. You cannot build a system that never fails.
That's just not possible.
Right. Hardware constraints and the laws of physics guarantee that network blips will occur. True distributed systems engineering is about designing containment zones.
Containment zones.
Yes. When failure is properly bounded, contained, and accurately classified, the chaos disappears and the system finally becomes predictable under load.
Which leaves us with a fascinating puzzle to consider. Something that builds on this boundary model, but points toward the future of how we deploy code.
Okay.
The entire failure boundary model we just discussed relies on having a persistent infrastructure layer that can sit there, hold open a thread, and absorb a 15-second network blip.
Right. It assumes the compute layer is long-lived.
But what happens when you move to a completely serverless architecture?
Oh, that completely flips the script.
Exactly. Imagine you are running on ephemeral compute functions like AWS Lambda, where you were billed by the millisecond. Sitting around absorbing a 15-second infrastructure transition suddenly costs real money.
It gets expensive fast.
Furthermore, your serverless function might have a hard execution time out of 5 seconds. If the raft election takes 10 seconds, the compute environment will literally die before the infrastructure stabilizes.
That's a huge problem.
Right. Does the move toward stateless, ephemeral edge compute fundamentally break this boundary model? If the compute layer is too short-lived to absorb the instability of the stateful data layer, where does the retry boundary move?
That's the big question.
Does it get pushed all the way out to the API gateway or back to the client? I highly encourage you, as you're listening, to look at your own architecture, especially if you're utilizing serverless components, and ask yourself, exactly where do your retry boundaries live, and are they actually capable of outlasting the failovers they're trying to hide?
It's definitely something to think about.
Thank you for joining us on this exploration of system resilience. We will catch you on the next deep dive.